It's one of those phrases you may well have never expected to hear on TPN Rock, but now, Iron Maiden. Yes, it's a show with a difference today. April the 21st is Iron Maiden Day, with 400 cinemas around the world screening Iron Maiden Flight 666, which is going to be the ultimate rock and roll tour movie. So we're going to clear the decks, and it's all Iron Maiden. It's going to be a lot of talking, lots of interviews. If you're here looking for the unsigned, the unknown, and the unforgettable music of unsigned bands from around the internet, come back on Friday for a full show. But for now, a little bit of this.
Every guy's dream to be a rock star, and you guys are living that dream. So could you give us a little insight about what it's really like backstage on tour? You know, the kind of stuff that you wouldn't want us to know.
Yeah, we could tell you, but we'd have to kill you.
Yes, Iron Maiden's Flight 666, very much a film that made my South by Southwest experience in Austin. Saw that there. It's first screening, I believe, in North America, the whole bundle of fans. One of them was Brian Lynch, a native of Austin, and I asked him what he thought of the film and how it measured up to one other classic tour film.
I think this is one of the best films in South by Southwest. Anybody who missed it really missed one of the highlights of the show.
I mean, you were sitting there and I heard a comment that you said, we want this on a midnight screening every month somewhere.
Yes. For years, Led Zeppelin's The Song Remains the Same would play in theaters all over the country at like midnight on Saturday, and there'd be these huge crowds that would come out because you couldn't see Led Zeppelin. They didn't tour much. And here in the United States, Iron Maiden only tours like once every 4 or 5 years, and there are a lot of Maiden fans who would definitely go to see this show.
On that same level as a Zeppelin film?
Actually, on a technical level, this is a much better film because it's done with better equipment, and I think the filmmakers really had a love of what they were doing. They had a lot of problems with the Zeppelin film because the film got stolen, they had to redo it, and I think this is just a far better film.
Of course, Flight 666 is no regular tour, even for a heavy metal band of Iron Maiden's stature. This was a tour that took in different areas of the world and had a very unique way of making sure that the band and their roadies and their kit could get to the next venue. Lead singer Bruce Dickinson.
The airplane idea started off as a crazy gleam in my eye, and I went, wow, if you could get all your gear into an airplane, you could cut down hugely on the amount of dead space we have in touring. So I said, what happens if you just join up all the countries that accountants say, you can't go there, it costs too much. And we just join them up and we go, bum, 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 bum. Yes, we can, because we've got our own magic carpet.
Bruce Dickinson there, of course, speaking as part of the film Flight 666, which goes out on release on April the 21st. While I didn't actually interview him, and both some of the clips and some of the music is taken from the trailers from the film at South by Southwest, I did get a chance to sit down for 15 minutes with people behind the film, Scott Murphy and Sam Dunn, to find out a little bit more about what, quite frankly, is probably one of the craziest adventures in rock history of the 20th and 21st century. I started off by asking them if they could just describe the film.
It is an emotional film. That's what people have been saying about it, and I think that makes us proud to the fact that we can make an emotional film about a bombastic heavy metal band.
I wanted to zero in straight away. It's a film about a band going on tour. We'll talk about the logistics in a second, but the scene that got me was right in the middle of the film. Was someone who'd got a drumstick at the end of the gig, and he just kept the camera on him while he just an almost religious experience he had.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I mean, I think too that's probably the that captures the film in its sort of purest form, and the guy was, you know, it was an emotional moment right at the right moment in the film, and then, you know, and then we cut away to the guys in the van, you know, eating pizza. And it was kind of interesting that they're this band that's so huge and their fans are so loyal, and but there is still sometimes a little bit of a disconnect, you know. And that's that, you know, it's, but definitely the fans are a big part of the film.
Huge part, you know. That comes after Run to the Hills, which is the song in Colombia, and the Colombian scene, I think, is one of the most alarming in the film, where you see the military presence at the venue, and you get a small taste of the kind of environment that these kids live in, with a very strong state police military presence, and every fan had to remove his or her shoes before they got in the venue. Everyone had their belts confiscated before they went into the venue. And so I think, and it was the first time that Iron Maiden had played in Colombia. And so I think what you see is rapture, because this is, people had been waiting a long, long time to see Iron Maiden.
The tour itself that Iron Maiden, this was part of their Somewhere in Time tour. And for those Iron Maiden fans who aren't aware of this tour, basically, they took all the places that bands don't tour and toured there.
Yeah, and the only way they could do that within a reasonable schedule was by taking a Boeing 757, altering it so you could pack a little more equipment onto it, and 70 band, crew and management, 12 tons of equipment, got on this plane and flew to India, Australia, all the way through Japan, North, Central and South America. And the only way they could do that huge itinerary was by doing it all in one vessel, and it had never been done before. So it was a bit of an experiment, and I think there was a lot of anxiety as to whether they could pull it off, and they did. So it's quite amazing.
For a band who are so close-knit and very protective of their social life, to the point of, you know, they're quite happy to have a mascot because that can go on the album covers and not their faces.
Yeah. Mm.
For such a risky endeavour, why do you think that they were happy for the film crew, even with your history in these sort of documentaries, to come along?
I don't think they were always happy with the film crew being there, to tell you the truth. But I think, you know, I think Rod trusts us, Bruce trusted us, Steve came on board, but, you know, sometimes, you know, Yannick or some of the guys were not that crazy to have us around, and it took us a while. You know, we wanted to take it slowly with them, and we got to know them before we started putting the cameras in their face. You know, it was a week before I sort of just, with the camera, slowly just opened up the change room, and all of a sudden I was standing there with a camera, and I wasn't sure how they were going to react. But eventually they got to know us. They knew that we were nice people and that we weren't out to make some expose documentary on the band. We knew it wasn't some kind of monster. It was more of a celebration of Iron Maiden.
As film creators and needing to build up such a close relationship and needing to have so much trust from the band, did you ever have feel that yourself, you were in an awkward position where it's like, I really want to get the camera behind that closed door, but if I do, we're going to lose the entire film?
Certainly, I think the door to the dressing room felt like a bit of an iron curtain sometimes. That was sort of the last frontier, and you know, as the film goes on, there's more and more scenes in that atmosphere, to the point later in the film in Brazil, and Bruce is like running around in his underwear with the cameras and he just doesn't give a shit, you know. I think that that was sort of a barrier, but I think the best way to get to know the guys early on, we just got in the vans with them after every show, and it was interesting because it was an environment where it was clear that the adrenaline was running so high and they'd been in that situation so many times. So the fact that we were there with a camera, they didn't even notice us. And so that was one way to sort of capture their personalities, because they're totally off guard. And then from there, we just, you know, I think they just got used to us being around.
With Iron Maiden being such a huge fan following, but yet still invisible to anyone that's not specifically looking out for them, do you think this documentary is going to stay as a treasure for the fans, which will still sell, hopefully, millions of tickets and millions of copies and so on? Or do you think this will actually push them over the edge and actually give them some mainstream recognition?
I mean, certainly that's... It is a fine... I don't know if it's going to completely bring them into mainstream recognition, right? You know, I think people are... But it will make some headway into that area. And, you know, our goal with coming to a film festival like South by Southwest, for instance, is it's not a big metal festival, but the word of mouth will spread into the area. It's worth seeing if you're not an Iron Maiden fan. And that's the kind of message we're trying to get across to people. When we were editing the film, we would invite people to the screening room, and we would invite Iron Maiden fans. We'd invite all of our friends that are not fans of Iron Maiden and see if they could sit through the documentary. And so that's definitely was a goal. And a lot of them walked away, you know, being either fans now or having at least some respect for the band, you know, and not right. Because immediately when you think, oh, Bruce, you know, lead singer's flying the plane, you think it's going to be some kind of motley crew sex fest on the plane, and if you don't know about that, right?
Yeah.
And this is, it's, I mean, when they see it, they're like, oh, that's complete.
Kids, look up Motley Crue on Wikipedia.
And compare with Iron Maiden, and you'll get a sense of the two very different bands.
Yeah.
And to a certain extent, the band have never sought that mainstream appeal, and that probably makes them a great documentary subject.
That's what I was going to add, is that I don't think that mainstream appeal is, one, what the band is seeking, and two, what they need.
And they even care.
Precisely. They've sold 70 million records and have one of the biggest international fan bases of any band, of any genre. They give Coldplay, U2, all of the biggest bands on the planet right now a serious run for the money. No one else is pulling 70,000 fans in Sao Paulo as a headliner, not part of a festival. I mean, no one. So I think that the goal of the documentary is not necessarily to catapult them into any kind of mainstream orbit. It's more to illustrate how they've succeeded without that. And the way that they've done that is through this very intimate relationship with fans. Case in point, this last show they just played in Sao Paulo, which ended up being the biggest show of their career, when they were scheduled to go on stage, there was still 10,000 fans lined up outside because they had all arrived at one time, and because it had been raining and blah, blah, blah. Anyways, they hadn't got into the venue yet. Maiden delayed the start time by, I think, an hour or an hour and a half to make sure these kids could get into the venue. Now, a band like Iron Maiden does not need to do that. And I think what's impressive is that they do, even though they've sold 70 million records and they've sold the tickets anyways. So I think they really recognize how much the fans mean to what they've accomplished.
What was in the film the most challenging time, because you two had to do the tour as well, what was the most challenging time for you both personally?
You know, as it went on, we had 2 days off in 8 weeks, and by the time we get to South America, it was, you know, a show, travel, and if there was days off for the band, we were filming. You know, it just became, at some point, just an incredibly exhausting process, and, you know, it just got more and more difficult. It took us a couple months just to get over it.
there's so much detail in this film. I mean, we could talk about the sound editing, we could talk about the visual, we could talk about the logistics, we could talk about the chase plane for all the shots of the of the Boeing 757, which just makes it look like 5 minutes of Top Gun. There's just so much depth and detail in this film. And what do you do now? What are you going to do with all that footage and all that extra stuff? Is this a second disc? Is this a three disc? Is this some monster Blu-ray distribution? What happens now outside of the core film?
Well, lock it up.
I don't know. Steve Harris has asked for us to send him. It's like 10 terabytes of material, and we're going to send it to him, and we'll see it. Let him play around with it.
Don't go send it via Google. I don't think Gmail handles 10 terabytes yet.
Yeah,
but the second disc on the DVD will include each song in its entirety from each city that we visited, plus a couple of other songs that don't appear in the film. For instance, Moonchild is in the film, but we don't see Moonchild being performed, and also Clairvoyant will be on the second disc as well.
So essentially there's an assemblage of one concert but made up from one song from each city.
Yeah, so you get the complete Aces High from Mumbai, then you get the complete 2 Minutes to Midnight from Melbourne, and so on and so on and so on.
And Bruce, when we were there, he asked us if we could do just one basic, just on the plane and the logistics of the plane, you know, do it for some other network. And we were just like, that's not interesting to us. We had about 40 hours of just Bruce talking about, every time you get him, like, just going about airplanes and aviation, it's just, he'll talk your ear off, you know, and he gets so, it's like a little boy, he's so excited about it. But it's not good TV, you know.
It's exactly like Neil Peart and motorcycling. Is that I think what's interesting is that when these artists get at a point in their career when they've accomplished so much, and they need other aspects of their lives to drive them forward. You get Bruce, who loves aviation, and you get Neil Peart, and he would much rather talk about motorcycles than Rush's music. So.
Oh, I have to say, you said like giddy kid there. The film itself works for the non-fans. I had a non-fan sitting next to me on one side, and I had an actual fan sitting next to me on the other side, and I had my little inner fan. And my little inner fan was ready to run really, really hard to the front of the cinema once Aces High kicked off. And I'm like, no, you're in a cinema. So I think that's going to be a testament to the effect of the film on the fans. And the non-fan next to me, well, Eddie came out, and he just like went, oh my god, they're huge.
Well, that, I mean, like, the goal of the film was to make it very experiential, so the details and the level and the scope, I think it's difficult to capture an Iron Maiden live show, like, because when you're there and you hear it and you hear the crowd and singing along, like this natural 5.1 happening with you, and you're just like, how do I capture this? Like, and that's what our goal was, to get something that's just so, you know, it doesn't have to be 3D. It really is, like, gets you going.
Yeah, just to add to that, I think it surprises me the number of concert films or music documentaries you see which, A, have a very sort of sterile presentation of the band. You're in the audience and you're watching the band. And what we tried to do was to be everywhere, be on stage, be backstage, be in the front row, be at the back of the football stadium, be in the middle of the pit, because I think that's an exciting way to capture a concert, and it puts you there. And also, secondly, I think I'm shocked the level to which bands shoot concerts and the fans have no presence in the film, because I think one of my favorite quotes in the film is when Bruce talks about playing in Mexico and Latin America, and he says that we have to live up to the crowd. When we go to Central America, the dynamic shifts where we have to outperform the crowd. And I think that to properly document a Maiden show, you can't do it without having that crowd presence. So that was something that was important to us as well.
We've got screenings,
400 cities or 400 theaters. I guess that is 400, pretty much 400 cities around the world in 23 countries, and all on Iron Maiden Day, April 21st. And I think there's 70 cinemas in the UK. So it's good. Kilmarnock. Kilmarnock.
Right, this, yes, Austin, cinemas all around the world, fly around at Kilmarnock, yes. I think on that rather strange note, I have to say. Full details on the screening and Iron Maiden Day will be at ironmaiden.com. Guys, Scott, Sam, thank you very much.
Cheers.
Thank you.
Here now with, what, the seventh man of the sound of Iron Maiden, at least nowadays, Kevin Charlie. Kevin, what a fantastic sounding film.
Well, I'm glad you enjoyed it.
You enjoyed it. You've been quite modest there. I think the mix in there, and obviously it's a huge team effort, and you've worked with the team before, but this has really captured it more than any other album that I've listened to, or even some of the DVDs that have come out recently.
Well, you know, it helps when you manage to get the surround sound and get in the middle of it, and it's really designed to feel, you know, sometimes we do DVDs to make you feel like you're in the front row. This one you're meant to feel like you're right in the middle of it, but there's also like some definition. So
when you heard about the tour,
right,
what were your initial thoughts?
Well, you know, if anyone can pull it off, they can pull it off. See, I don't doubt Maiden at all. There's nothing that they can't do. So I didn't think anything of it. I mean, you have to get to know Bruce, and you realize that if he wanted to take them to the moon, you wouldn't even second-guess it. You know, they can do anything.
And what do you think about the filmmakers, the actual result?
I think they did an amazing job. I think they did a really cool job. I think they've done I think they've captured this, like, the real sense of humor that there is about the band, the sense of family that there is about the band, the sense of, there's like a real morality to the band. When you always expect them to be, you know, blood-curdling, you know, whatever, motorbike riding, you know, chains and boots, but they're just like normal everyday cats who play music and love it.
And have taken over the world's hearts.
And have taken over, and good to see, you know. It shows what a little perseverance can do and a little hard work.
No problem. Thanks for your time, Kevin.
Great, thank you.
Iron Maiden fans around the world, as we've seen in the documentary Flight 666, just have a passion that is unbridled almost anything. Joining me now is a fan who's come out from India to see the film. Rohan, welcome.
Hi, what's up?
And you're sitting there, and having been the fan who's furthest away, you've got the actual standout from the launch of the film. That, I suspect, signed
by Sam, Kevin and Scott, all three of them. Kevin Shirley, Scott McFadden and Sam Dunn.
And it's just a fantastic souvenir that you need to make sure you get home safely. Seriously though, now, the emotions that were coming out of the fans in the film, is that how you feel about them?
Well, probably a little bit more if I came 10,000 miles away just to watch the film and the concert. I saw the first concert in Mumbai, and I think I'm going to watch the last one too over here in St. Lauderdale. But Iron Maiden for me is something I can't even explain what it is because I have no words for it. Yeah, I don't mind saying this, but I cried when Iron Maiden played Moonchild in India. It was after the encore. And a lot of people didn't really know that song because it's not one of the songs that Iron Maiden plays too often. But as soon as Bruce just said Seven Deadly Sins, and I just wept tears over there, and I couldn't stop crying. Oh, by the way, I was in the movie too. I had a couple of shots of me, you know, just showing the devil's horns and screaming out my lungs. Yeah, this is actually the second time I've been in an Iron Maiden video. I was there in one of the videos, which was only displayed for the Iron Maiden fan club members, about the Bombay concert, and I was there in that one too, and this one also. So I was actually hoping that I would be in this video, and I was there, and I was just jumping in my seat. So yeah, I'm still actually quite phased out, you know. I don't know what's happening because it's been such a great day. I got such a great souvenir, the tickets, signings from Scott, Sam and Kevin, so it's just too amazing for me.
Wonderful film. Thanks for your time, Rob.
I'm sorry?
Thank you for your time.
Oh, thank you all.
So there we go, Iron Maiden Day. This is April the 21st. If you're going to be at the Edinburgh Film House, I shall be there, hiding in the back. I'm not going to spoil the film for you, but don't worry, you do get all of Rime of the Ancient Mariner. Unlike today's special show, we'll be back to normal service on Friday. Catch you then. Ta-ra.